This is DomesticPreparedness.com. Since 1998, Domestic Preparedness has been a source of solutions for the professional preparedness community. Your host today is the managing editor, John Morton.
This audio interview is sponsored by MSA, the global leader in the development, manufacture, and supply of sophisticated safety products. To learn more, visit www.msanorthamerica.com.
Domestic Preparedness is with Judith Miller, the author and Pulitzer Prize-winning former investigative reporter for the New York Times, currently a writer for several publications, among them the Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, and New York Sun. She also appears on television as a commentator on national security, where she focuses on the Middle East and counterterrorism. Last month, she got our attention when she published an article in the City Journal, the urban policy magazine of the Manhattan Institute. The topic was the New York and Los Angeles Police Department's strategies on counterterrorism. While she's here in Washington, we thought we should talk to her about some of her findings and other topics on her radar. Judy, thanks for taking time to chat with us.
Good to be here, John.
Well, I want to open talking about intelligence-led policing. From reading your article, I'm reminded of that term, which has become a term of art in recent years, and my understanding is the approach emphasizes a police mindset that's oriented to intelligence gathering as opposed to evidence gathering. Now, sometimes one hears the term applied to police first preventers, so it's in the same sort of understanding. Tell me, is this sort of orientation what you're finding in New York, L.A., and elsewhere when it comes to counterterrorism strategies for law enforcement?
Absolutely. This is the mantra of both the NYPD and now the LAPD under Bratton's leadership out there. I think it is the wave of the future in policing, especially as local law enforcement is required to take on more of the burden of counterterrorism work from the FBI.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's pretty common knowledge in police and intel circles that the New York and Los Angeles police departments have had for years been the exceptions with their overseas presence and operations. But you write in your article that the NYPD got funds from the Police Foundation, which was initially endowed by the Ford Foundation, to send liaison officers overseas to work alongside police departments. And that was in some of the cities most frequently targeted by terror, like Amman, Jordan, London, and Singapore. Can you tell us a little bit more about that program? And my understanding, there's what, about 10 officers serving in 8 countries? Do you see that as something other departments might replicate?
I think it's expensive, but I think the NYPD feels that it has more than paid off for it. I had an opportunity to spend some quality time with the NYPD rep in London and in Jerusalem, actually, / Tel Aviv. These are New York City detectives. Mm-hmm. They had never been overseas. One of them, the one in Israel, speaks fluent Hebrew, which is definitely an advantage and is embedded, if you will, with the national police.
Mm-hmm.
In London, the NYPD guy was really taken in to the law enforcement family there. And as a result, I think New York got what we'd call TTP in the Army, you know, tactics, procedures, got an insight into new trends in the terrorist front that the department wouldn't have had without these guys embedded there. I remember going around Tel Aviv, looking at a former bomb site with Mort Jasansky, who was the NYPD guy there. And he showed me some of the memos that he had sent back to New York. New York cops would not ordinarily stop a woman who's pushing a baby carriage down the street.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Mort had actually seen some Palestinian terrorists load baby carriages with dynamite, with with Semtex, with explosives, and do just that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when you have an NYPD policeman say to his colleagues, you've got to think outside the box. What seems innocent maybe dangerous. Mm-hmm. It has the kind of resonance that you wouldn't get if someone who's not of them giving them practical tips. And they also just got extraordinary information about tentative or potential links between terrorist activities in those cities and our own city of New York. So I think that the NYPD has found that that program is very valuable, so much so that out in Los Angeles, Chief Bratton is now trying to put together a group of police agencies that don't have the resources that New York has to pool resources to send someone over there to worry about their cities. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, to do a secondary deployment. Now, obviously, you can't have too many cities doing this, or first of all, the foreign capitals would go nuts, mm-hmm. and they would reject it. But I think on a limited basis, it can be enormously helpful. I once asked Commissioner Kelly, if the Police Foundation were not funding this, would you do so? As the acid test of whether or not he found the program mm-hmm. useful, and he said yes, he would fund it.
Mm-hmm. In this segment, I'd like to first look at the New York Police Department. I want to talk a little bit about the use of Washington folks that have come up there to work for the NYPD. Michael Sheehan, former State Department head of counterterrorism, runs the force's new counterterrorism bureau.
Well, he did. He doesn't mm-hmm. any longer. He retired last year and was replaced by Richard Falkenrath.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, tell me about both of those gentlemen's impact, because, of course, Richard was an academic expert on counterterrorism and had experience working at the White House in the Bush administration. So, generally, what did those two gentlemen bring to the table from their Washington experience?
I think they brought their Washington experience with them.
Yeah.
One thing that Commissioner Kelly really wanted was people who knew how to interact with the federal counterterrorism establishment, the national security establishment. And in Mike Sheehan, he got somebody who was not only a veteran of special forces himself, mm-hmm. but also someone who had worked in the State Department as the head of counterterrorism.
Mm-hmm.
So you had someone who knew the State Department bureaucracy, who had worked in the White House, and who had been a practitioner on the ground as a special forces guy. So Sheehan's contribution, because even though he wasn't the first head of that, the first to hold mm-hmm. that post, that was Labuti, John Labuti, who held it. Sheehan really organized it, and he made it an active counterterrorism bureau and function. I think with Richard Falkenrath, one of his major contributions has been to give Commissioner Kelly and his department a sense of the Republican establishment, because Richard has worked for for President Bush for almost since the beginning of the administration, and New York and every police department needs federal resources, and Richard, I think, has been very helpful in helping New York figure out how to get the resources that it needs to do the job, because it was having trouble, and Richard has, I think, made a big difference in that area.
Now, do you see that as a pattern that might be adopted by other cities, bringing Washington experience to bear in police departments?
If they can afford them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these guys are hard to get away from Washington. In the case of Mike Sheehan, he had served for a long time in Washington. Mm-hmm. He was eager for a change and a new challenge. We haven't talked about Dave Cohen yet, but the same there. After 25-plus mm-hmm. years at the CIA, he, yeah. too, was ready. I think that people with Washington experience can be enormously helpful.
Mm-hmm.
To local law enforcement and vice versa, by the way.
Indeed, yeah. Well, let's go back to Sheehan. His bureau focuses primarily, as I understand it from your article, on the financial district in Lower Manhattan. Commissioner Kelly, though, you mentioned, has a plan for a ring of steel around that area with cameras and random screenings and the like, similar to those in London. Now, tell me, is the financial district going to remain their priority, or do you see them incorporating such protection strategies elsewhere in the city?
I see
other boroughs.
I see it starting with the financial district and spreading. And this is something of great concern to civil libertarians in New York. The ACLU, the New York branch, is enormously concerned both about the installation of this kind of surveillance in Lower Manhattan, but they're even more worried about it spreading beyond that. You know, it's really interesting to me. The British don't seem to mind being photographed and having their license plates recorded and all of the things that they now take for granted over there, whereas Americans still have a hard time adjusting to that. And so there's a real debate in New York about whether or not this is politically and financially acceptable.
Now, you mentioned David Cohen. He was the former deputy director of the CIA's operations wing. Well, he now heads the NYPD's intelligence division.
Yes, this is the heart of what the NYPD does. And I think it is the truly innovative program and area of policing for the NYPD. Now, this is going to sound a little simplistic, but it is a shorthand and I think a pretty accurate way of describing what's going on. David Cohen has set up a kind of mini CIA inside the NYPD with some awesome linguistic and intellectual resources. What David Cohen has done is decide to deploy on a pretty systematic basis in areas that he thinks are potentially problematic, a set of confidential informants and undercover people who work for the NYPD or are part of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and his own set of analysts to process and examine what these people bring in. And it is this kind of policing that the police say, now it's very hard for us on the outside to evaluate this, but they say this is what has led to the foiling of various plots against New York. And we saw that in the public discussion of the effort to blow up the Herald Square subway station just at the time of the Republican National Convention, and the JFK plot more recently to blow up fuel lines leading to JFK. It is this kind of undercover surveillance that is at the heart of what the NYPD now does. And it is, once again, another potential point of conflict with the civil libertarian community that says you need a darn good reason to spy on New Yorkers or people resident in the city. So once again, another potential point of friction and of debate.
Well, you had mentioned the use of the linguists, and in your article you say that the force has more linguists than the FBI's field office in New York. Is that right?
Almost more than the FBI in Washington.
Wow.
It wasn't until the FBI expanded its linguistic capability in Washington. Until that point, the NYPD had greater language speakers because, look, it's the international city of New York. Everybody comes there. Immigrants come there. Pashto, Hindu, Hindi. I mean, just on and on and on. 65 languages in capability. A graduating class with 60 officers speaking various languages. And that's wonderful because, frankly, it's easier to become a New York City policeman than it is to join the FBI. It's just a lot easier, and it's an incoming step into law enforcement, and New York has really capitalized on that capability.
Wow. Cohen's division has, among other things, the Cyber Intelligence Unit. What can you tell us about that area?
This is an amazing unit, very similar to what the FBI has. They monitor broadcasts all over the world in various languages. They also are online monitoring the chat rooms, the jihadi chat rooms that have sprung up all over the world. They try and decipher the encrypted communications between and among these groups and units, and they are 24/7 doing this. It's a small group of people at the moment, but I think it's yet another growth area for the NYPD.
In this segment, I want to talk a little bit more about what you touched on, the NYPD's relations with the FBI. The New York field office for the FBI has about 2,000 agents. New York is one of the largest police departments in the world. There's a lot at stake. From your article, you mentioned that Commissioner Kelly was pushing for one of his officers to chair the JTTF up there. Now, how did that shake out once the FBI's Mark Mershon became the chair? It's evolved into a co-management, right?
It's much more of a co-management than it was before, and relations, I am told, are vastly improved from what they were before. But that's not hard, given how bad the relationship was when I first started looking at this area a couple of years ago. It had gotten so bad that there were people who weren't talking to each other, who were supposedly working together. And each side was withholding information that the other needed simply because of bureaucratic tensions.
Yeah.
And I think most people understood that this was not a good way to do business if you're trying to fight terror, but they just couldn't figure out a way to get beyond the problems, some of which were institutional and bureaucratic, but others of which just involved the personalities, you know, people who had been in entrenched positions for a long time. I think it was generally agreed that something had to be done, and finally something was. Mueller, the head of the FBI, came up to New York. Mohammed goes to the mountain and met with Kelly, what the Israelis would call a four eyes discussion.
Four eyes.
They were first just the two of them and then a small group of aides. But they basically hashed out their problems, their differences. Each had a very full and frank, to use diplomatic parlance of Washington, to express their grievances. And as a result, the leadership of the field office was changed in New York. And New York, the NYPD made some concessions. And now Mark Mershon, who's the new head of the field office, is supposedly getting along extremely well with the NYPD people. And the NYPD also agreed to assign extra policemen to the JTTF, which was another FBI demand. You're shortchanging us. You're doing your own thing. And now everybody says that relations are as good as they've ever been. Whether or not they're really good, I don't know. I think there's still a residual of resentment and bad blood, and there's always going to be because you have two very high-powered, bureaucratic, well-entrenched groups, each thinking that it knows the best way to go about things. So to a certain extent, there's always going to be some friction, but I think it is such progress to know that they've gotten past the really acrimonious and bitter relations that existed before.
Do you ever see, given we're now saying the realization's come to pass that local law enforcement is on the front line, that a local police department chair will be in a JTTF either in New York or anywhere else in the country?
I don't really see that for the moment because I think the FBI is pretty determined to always maintain leadership of these critical units for its fight against terrorism. But I think you can see something like what has developed in New York, where you have a kind of co-management or people who get along so well that there is a full sharing of information. We could talk about L.A. later, but they simply have no tradition of this kind of tension. And I think history plays a role in the current set of relationships. I'm very struck, John, by the extent to which local law enforcement has really been underutilized in the fight against terror. I think if you had I did not know that moment for me, it was realizing that you have all of these incredible resources at the local and state level, 700,000 people, many of whom are very eager to be involved in this struggle against terrorism and who simply lack the training or the resources to be involved. And that's where the FBI can be enormously, enormously helpful and proactive if it chooses to be so, because these are people waiting and ready to become part of this effort and who up until now really heretofore have not been as involved as they should be. So that's the basic message that I take away from spending 2 months with these guys.
I'm going to turn now to talk a little bit about NYPD information sharing, because it picks up on what we were saying with the relationship with the FBI. Now, the fusion centers are common all across the country nowadays, but what makes New York so exceptional? Is it size? I understand from your article there are counterterrorism reps from some 40 local, state, and federal agencies represented there. Is that correct?
Right. It, once again, size matters. Mm-hmm. It's a question of size. It's a question of resources. I think in a strange way, because the NYPD is so active, the fusion center is of less importance than it is in other areas, mm-hmm. where it is the local law enforcement's, the policeman's only access to federal information. There was recently a pretty stunning GAO report that was very critical of the fusion centers, saying they're basically just recycling, by the time it gets recycled, pretty old information, and that they're not as terrible, as helpful as they should be and could be. LA's fusion center gets very good marks, and the Department of Homeland Security has made it a kind of showcase place. I went out there. It's located in Norwalk. Let me tell you, Norwalk is a long, long way from anything.
Yeah.
And the center in Norwalk might be a good place for all the agencies to get together. It could never serve as an emergency management center unless downtown LA is obliterated in a strike, because it's simply, the distances are too vast, it's too hard to get to. And I think in that sense, L.A. is more reflective of the situation for most local law enforcement than New York. New York is a vertical city. Everything's pretty concentrated. Good public transport linking mm-hmm. all these places. Not true in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
So the concept of fusion, my own sense is that fusion, we need to work more on electronic fusion, on email fusion, on spreading information through ways other than kind of physically getting everybody in a room. On the other hand, for some things, there's just no substitute for getting everybody in a room.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Sheehan made a really interesting point to me when we were talking about his former job. He said, he doesn't believe in information sharing in the way that the Fusion Center does. That is, the taking of federally gathered information and diffusing it out there to the local and state law enforcement. He believes in information sharing. And that means that local law enforcement has to do more to develop its own source of information that it can fuse with the federal information in order to have a full picture. And I think that's the model I would like to see developed, and I'm not quite sure where that's going on at the moment.
That would be actually in Delaware.
In Delaware.
Yeah, where the Fusion Center in Delaware receives input from the chicken poultry farms, right? Because it's a resource in the Eastern Shore, and if avian flu hits, they want to know about it real time.
That's a very good example, yeah. I think, of a natural as opposed to unnaturally
locally,
inspired
locally
disaster, but
locally informed.
In which local information is crucial, as it always is. Mm-hmm. It almost always would be in bio, by mm-hmm. the way. In a bioterrorism attack, the first warning you mm-hmm. would have is the person who shows up at the pharmacist counter
yeah.
or the emergency hospital complaining of flu-like symptoms. So we know that, but institutionalizing that mm-hmm. has proven to be a greater challenge than I think we expected.
Now, in terms of the FBI and information sharing, you write that the Bureau now accepts that the Intelligence Division was an additional source of vital intelligence, which makes your point. Now, would you say at this point there's a good two-way street going?
I think there is. I think while the NYPD and the FBI don't choose to share everything, I think they are much better at sharing what needs to be shared. And the proof ultimately, cliche, is in the pudding. I mean, yes, I'm sure we've been lucky, and perhaps Al-Qaeda hasn't been able to mobilize the kind of second attack, second spectacular that it, I'm sure its minions dream of, but there have been some serious plots diverted or thwarted, and I think as much as people like to say, no, it's not anything that because of anything we're doing, I think that's not right. I think it is because of some of the things that the local law enforcement and the FBI are doing, whether or not its critics like to acknowledge that.
Now, you mentioned Norwalk. Operation Sentry is the police department's effort to forge the counterterrorism partnerships within a 200-mile radius of New York City. And that enables the local forces to leverage the NYPD assets. But I assume this is also a two-way street, right?
This is. And, John, if I have to point to one program that I think may be the kind of wave of the future, if local law enforcement is going to step up to the plate, it's going to be because of programs like Sentry. Sentry had its first formal meeting. There were informal contacts long before this, but last December, because Ray Kelly is absolutely a workaholic, the likes of which I have a very few of whom I've seen in government, even in Washington, he decided shortly before Christmas to convene a meeting of all of these local law enforcement people. He issued invitations to the police chiefs of major cities, all as far away as Baltimore, and I think even Washington was included, and invited them to New York for a 2 or 3 day session. And they basically, what the NYPD did is it took these law enforcement people through New York's programs, what they look like, how they operate, how undercover and CI work is done. And the message of this was, you can do this too. You may think that you're a small department and that you can't contribute information that's vital, but that's not true. Because you guys all out there already infiltrate drug groups, you already infiltrate gangs, you know how to do this, you know how to do it in your area. Expand your horizon and include the potentially militant group that may be living and operating in your area. Because, you know, you don't have to live in New York in order to strike New York. And what NYPD wanted to do is to harness the information that these local law enforcement agencies can provide and to make sure that the next time somebody unusual visits Portland or Boston a la the 9/11 strikes, someone on the ground there notices that something may be wrong. And I think that local law enforcement can do this. It's able to do it. It just needs some training, some resources to be able to do it, and that's what Operation Sentry is all about.
In this segment, I want to talk about the NYPD links to the private sector. Operation Nexus is the program that links the force with the business community. Judy, tell us about that program.
This is one of the first programs that I began reporting on when I was still at the New York Times. I noticed that the NYPD was spending a lot of time with businesses in the New York area, and all kinds of businesses, from people who shipped and produced chemicals in the city to people who are responsible for radiation sources in the city at our many hospitals and medical laboratories that do testing, from people who sold underwater scuba equipment. And they were visiting them. They were making these businesses familiar with the kind of concerns that the NYPD had about strange and unusual behavior. And I said, well, why scuba divers? And they said, well, you know, we're always worried about underwater attacks on our bridges and our tunnels. And if you have a guy who's placed an from the Middle East or not from the Middle East who's placed an unusually large order for underwater explosives or even scuba equipment, you want to know who's doing the buying and why. And through these visits, and there have been more than 30,000 of them now, through the Nexus operation, New York has gotten to know the people who sell this kind of equipment and has gotten yet again another channel of information. Mm-hmm. So the New York City mantra, if you see something, say something, is really institutionalized through a program like this, and the NYPD develops links to the business community, which is very helpful to them as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's another, Operation Shield, which helps area businesses assess and revise their security. It also shares unclassified intelligence with security tips with the private sector security firms. Now, how's that working, and what are the success stories?
This is an extraordinarily successful program. I attended the last meeting that was held in One Police Plaza, the auditorium. There were about 350, 400 security people from private companies all over the city and the tri-state area, and they were getting a briefing on explosive devices and chemicals. Everyone is concerned about what's going on in Iraq, about the vehicle bombings, about roadside bombings, and especially when it concerns the transportation of chemicals through the city. And the NYPD used Dave Cohen's analyst to give presentations on different aspects of what moves through the city, the techniques that have been developed in Iraq, the techniques we're worried about here. And all of these private security people were briefed mm-hmm. on that. Mm-hmm. They take that information back to their companies, and they adjust their own planning mm-hmm. and their own plans to correspond to what the NYPD is worried about. And once again, it's a situation in which people get together, mm-hmm. in which the analysts who do the work get to hear the concerns of the security people in the audience who ask questions. These are wonderful sessions, mm-hmm. and there have been about one, I guess, every other month on a different topic. And you're talking about building a community again and strengthening that community and enabling it to be better prepared for the trends that may be coming at us mm-hmm. from the terror hotspots of mm-hmm. the world.
So you'd say they've been successful in encouraging the private firms to support and report suspicious activity?
Yes.
What sort of firms have been most responsive, and are there any that haven't?
I'm told that almost every firm has been responsive. I know even newspapers have been responsive. The Wall Street Journal, for which I'm now writing part-time and on an occasional piece, they, of course, had learned a painful, horrible mm-hmm. lesson because they were next to the Trade Center mm-hmm. and they had their mm-hmm. office closed for a year. But even the New York Times, which opened a new building at Port Authority, mm-hmm. opposite Port Authority, and opened a glass building, which has its own set of concerns, mm-hmm. Worked closely with the NYPD in the beginning in the security planning. I think this kind of give and take now is becoming standard, and that's mm-hmm. as it should be, I mm-hmm. think.
In this segment, let's turn now to the LAPD and their counterterrorism model. Chief Bratton, you've mentioned, has neither the funds nor the manpower that New York does. Yet LA is geographically a much larger challenge than New York horizontally. So he pools his counterterrorism resources and information with federal and other agencies. Now, I think you're saying this is the model that the federal officials hold up for the other big city police departments. Can you tell us why?
Simply because Chief Bratton has to struggle with the problems that they struggle with. I mean, New York has the resources because New York has been a target, not just once, but twice successfully hit. So in New York, the threat of terrorism is palpable. It's every day. It's staring you in the face. And if you work downtown, L.A. and other cities just have a very different attitude towards terrorism. It's something that's happened by and large to other people, mm-hmm. not to them. And therefore, resources are simply harder to come by. And if resources are scarce, you have to pool what you've got. Mm-hmm. And Chief Bratton has done a wonderful job, an amazing job, getting money out of the very tight-fisted city council. But the degree of control of that by that city council of his department is something that Ray Kelly would never tolerate, mm-hmm. not in an instant. Mm-hmm. But it's, I think that too corresponds to the reality that most police chiefs face across the country, and that is a lot of people second-guessing, a lot of bosses who have to be satisfied, and people who have to know that this is the inappropriate use of resources. Look, everybody has to battle crime, burglary, murder. Terrorism, that seems like a threat that's further away from you, especially if you're in a city that's not on the front lines, that's not a frontline target. So Chief Bratton really didn't have a choice. This is the situation he inherited. He came from New York, so it must have been a tremendous cultural, psychological shift, but I think it is the reality out there.
Well, L.A. also has the California Highway Patrol, the CHIPS, the Port of Los Angeles Police, and the Airport Police. But the biggest that they work with and is also the best-funded local law enforcement office is the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. John Sullivan is the lieutenant out there, and he's one of our writers. So we know a little bit about their activities. But tell us, how does the LAPD and Sullivan's county force integrate their counterterrorism activities?
This has been integrated over time. I think one thing that impressed me was that, you know, if you've got 88 different municipalities, which you have out there, that could be bedlam. And yet, because of the close cooperation between the sheriff's office and the LAPD, the sheriff's office is actually bigger than the LAPD, you have had a tradition of cooperation that is a force multiplier. And one thing I saw when I was out there is the extremely good, the close ties that exist between, say, John Sullivan and his LAPD counterpart. They are used to working together because they've been forced to work together on a series of natural disasters. And kind of trial by fire. You know, they just literally and figuratively, they've had to come together to solve earthquakes, fires, droughts, floods. L.A. has it all. And that's very, very difficult given the Swiss cheese jurisdictional scene out there. The map is just, when I first looked at the map and I saw the number of people, of municipalities contracted out to either the Sheriff's Department or the LAPD, but who had their own standing forces but that actually didn't do local policing. I mean, it's just, it's very hard to figure out. So I was struck by the extent to which the Sheriff's Department and the LAPD often on the ground function as one unit.
Now, the director of the Manhattan Institute's Center for Policing Terrorism, Tim Connors, has been advising the LAPD. How has the Institute helped here? Are we talking about more than just support for Chief Bratton's National Police Academy? Tell us your thoughts there.
Yes, I think the Manhattan Institute is funding a full-time person who sits at the counterterrorism office at Chief Bratton and now Mike Downing's side. He's become the new head of the operation out there and is a source of information about what other cities are doing and what New York is doing, someone who can, a kind of go-to person for extra support for things they want to do. It's part of the Manhattan Institute is, once again, trying to be that force multiplier by giving the LAPD a person who is now almost a functioning part of that department. Usha's enormously talented, and she makes a difference out there on a lot of levels. So I think the Manhattan Institute's support is pretty important to the LAPD, and I think that Chief Bratton and Mike Downing would agree.
Now, you want to tell us a little bit about the National Police Academy, don't you?
Yes. This is something that I do hope will get off the ground. It's still in the planning stages. They've just had a couple of planning meetings. But once again, talking about the need for training, training is vital. If you take, there are so many talented policemen all over the country, women all over the country, law enforcement people who just need the skills, the know-how. They need to know what's been written and who's writing it. And these are things that can be taught. Mm-hmm. And I think the police academy in L.A. not only would be a desirable place for people to go if you're from Des Moines in winter or Pensacola in summer, it'd be nice to get out to L.A. You would have you have to develop this community. And a police academy, in addition to providing these law enforcement people with skills, would actually help forge this community. There's nothing like being able to pick up the phone if you have a potential terrorist threat in L.A. Mm-hmm. and see that someone has spent time in San Diego or in Newark or in Chicago to know the person who's doing that. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of thing that reporters do all the time. They know a reporter at community paper X, Y, or Z, or their counterparts who are supposed to be competing with one another, but who really share information. There's nothing like an academy to develop that kind of community, and I'm just surprised that we haven't had this on a local level heretofore. I'm really glad that these kinds of institutions are developing. I'm not concerned that we're going to have a national police force ever. The country's too big, too varied. Local control is essential to who we are and what we are. But we need greater sharing of information, of experience, of skills, and you can get that through something like an academy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In this segment, let's talk about information sharing with the LAPD. How do things play out between them and the FBI and the JTTF? Do they co-manage like they do in New York?
The FBI runs the Joint Terrorism Task Force in LA. There's no doubt about that. On the other hand, there is a history, as there is with the Sheriff's Department, of really smooth operating relations and a strong relationship. And you could see that on a personal level in terms of the person who's the head of that unit. It just works because they have worked together on so many problems and they get along. And because resources, once again, are shorter, there's a shortage of them out there, and so they've had to do it. And they've had some successes, they've had some glitches, but so far LA has not been hit, and you have to say they're doing something right out there.
Well, both Bratton and Michael Chertoff hold up the Joint Regional Intelligence Center out there as a model for similar fusion centers, soon to be operational in some 36 U.S. cities. Tell us how the JRIC is going and what law enforcement and public safety agencies are represented in it.
Once again, this is the Norwalk Center. The JRIC Fusion Center. I think these are excellent places for public health departments, people who have to worry about transportation in cities, for the different police departments to get together and the police different functions to come together, especially public health, which is oftentimes not included in policing activities, though it is certainly is in New York. So the JRIC is a place where they can meet physically in one room and exchange that information, get to know one another. Norwalk is a long way for all of them, except for perhaps it's closest to the Sheriff's Department. But in terms of what's shared, I think you need improvement. I think we've tended to see so far FBI information that's recycled and then spread out through the system. That's what's shared. Mm-hmm. What we don't have is enough input from the local people to the national. And that means they have to be more proactive in gathering information themselves that they can give to public health and to the transportation department and to others who are all involved in a common fight against terrorism. This will come, but I think establishing a place where they can all meet is just the first step in that. And I think that as the GAO concluded, we've got an awful long way to go before these centers become as important as they could be in the fight against terrorism. At the moment, these are baby steps and baby institutions.
So who leads the JREC? Is it the LAPD, the Sheriff's Office?
Well, that's another good question, John. Nobody seems to know. There isn't a designated person in charge. And so it's a, you know, they're kind of feeling their way. Someone suggested to me that that may be a good thing to have no one in charge because it means that everybody has to kind of do their bit. My gut instinct is that law enforcement in general, local and federal, is sufficiently hierarchical that you kind of need someone in charge because if everyone's in charge, nobody's in charge. But it's when I asked the question, who's in charge here, I got a, well, we're not quite sure.
Yeah. What about the security clearance process? That's always an issue.
Big problem everywhere I go when it takes over a year to get someone cleared. People who need to know you've got a problem. And the FBI says it's just doing the best it can, but it simply doesn't have the manpower to move these clearances fast enough. But it's, by the way, this is not just a law enforcement problem. I was out at Los Alamos recently, a national lab that does a lot of counterterrorism work. And the head of public affairs, who came from a major government contractor and a very sensitive one, had not been cleared, and he had been there for his job. He's in charge of public affairs. He could not literally go down the room to the cafeteria, take me down there without, because his clearance hadn't come through. And the last time I checked, which was last week, his clearance still hadn't come through. This is a government-wide problem.
You also write about Operation Archangel, the LAPD program that identifies, prioritizes, and protects critical infrastructure. You know, Tom McDonald briefed Archangel for us in Baltimore some time ago. He's the LAPD, I guess, chief of that effort. Archangel requires site owners and operators to provide the latest structural information. Do you say that it has full business buy-in at the moment?
I think there's a problem in Los Angeles in general, which is the buy-in. I think some companies are just very worried about sharing this kind of information about their operations. Archangel is off to a great start, and I understand that the software, the computer software that actually performs these rating functions and makes assessments of vulnerabilities is really impressive, but once again, you've put your finger on it, you need buy-in. LA's culture is just so laid back, and in general, hey, the weather's nice, let's go to the beach, no problem here. Terrorism is something that happens on the set of 24. It hasn't happened to us. And so you have a hard time fully integrating the private sector. In New York, private companies are eager for this information. In LA, less so if it means devoting considerable time and effort on their part to be part of it. So I think you have a cultural and psychological adjustment that needs to take place.
Okay, in this last segment, we're going to talk a little bit about some of your thoughts off topic, as it were. A number of our contributors wanted me to ask a few questions, given your considerable knowledge of the Middle East and the terrorist threat generally. One of our guys has asked whether you think that the types of domestic-sourced attacks and the attempted attacks in the UK are an indication of future threats and attacks in the US. Do you see that coming?
I think they could be. I think the, in fact, the NYPD is very focused on what it calls self-radicalization, and that is the increasing radicalization of Islamists. And I'm drawing a distinction here between Muslims. They are very concerned that these communities, especially of young people, could become ever more radical through their exposure to jihadi websites, some radical mosques. But, you know, young people are very inventive, and they find their own communities. And this is very much, I think, right now, the NYPD's major concern. I went to Israel in the spring to look at the suicide bombing question, and I wanted to answer the question, are we likely to have a kind of wave of suicide bombing attacks that they've seen in Israel in in Turkey and in other Sri Lanka and other countries. And so I was really given access, kind of extraordinary access, to some failed women suicide bombers in Israeli jails, and shown their profiles, discussed the cases, and then able to speak to these women for hours on end. And I came away both reassured and more concerned for our country, because on one hand, it became very clear to me that profiling is a waste of time and resources and very counterproductive, because when I would interview these women, it became clear that many of them weren't even political. Many of them were struggling with personal problems, issues of shame, shame crimes, honor crimes. They couldn't have children. They had an unhappy marriage. There were many, many factors that led them to strap on explosive vest and go into a supermarket in Tel Aviv. And therefore, the universe of potential suicide bombers was much greater than I had been led to believe by the profiles I had studied elsewhere. On the other hand, it also became clear to me through my interviews with these women that I wanted to call my article "It Takes a Village." You must have community support for this kind of terrorism. A person, male or female, just doesn't get up in the morning and decide, "I'm going to commit suicide for Allah and take a bunch of people with me." They decide that they might want to do this, but then it takes an entire community, the people who recruit them, the people who train them, the people who make the suicide vest, who show them how to put it on, the indoctrination that they undergo, the people who tape their statements, the people who make the posters celebrating their soon-to-be deaths, the people who make them heroes in the community, the network of mosque preachers, the poets who write poems in their honor. In other words, this never happened in Ireland because it wasn't socially, politically acceptable. What we have to do, the challenge for the United States and other countries fighting this kind of terror, is to delegitimize this form of activity. And if you don't have a geographic and political space to form this kind of community, you can have a one-off terrorist attack, suicide bombing, but I don't think you're going to have the wave that we've seen elsewhere. Our demographics are also very different from those of England mm-hmm. and from Europe. In Europe, you have mm-hmm. between, 30, 40, some say as many as 50 million Muslims. Mm-hmm. We here have between 4 and 6 million, a much tinier proportion. And of the Arab-American community, 75% mm-hmm. are Christian. So just in terms of numbers, we're dealing with a very different phenomenon. So I came away both concerned but reassured about the prospects for that kind of terrorism in our country.
How have New York and Los Angeles, for example, enlisted support from the mainstream Muslims here in the States?
I think both have active outreach programs now, and I think that outreach to Muslim Americans is critical, because these are the communities that will know when there is a stranger among them. These are the communities upon whom you must rely to cooperate with the undercover people, with the people gathering information. In several instances in New York, plots were prevented because fellow Muslims came forward and said, "I'm worried." Mm-hmm. They saw something and they said something. If you attempt to stigmatize these communities, you will create your enemy. It is the single most worrisome trend. It's understandable that people would be suspicious of, quote, Muslims, but it's not acceptable, either politically or from a law enforcement standpoint, because they are very much part of this war against mm-hmm. terror. And they must be made to feel that way, and hence the outreach is critical. I'm a little worried that some of the groups that purport to speak for Muslims actually contain some very radical elements themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think distinguishing the groups that are well-meaning and that really do represent people in a community is one of the challenges for local law enforcement.
Another question from one of our guys. How can the U.S. Emergency Services personnel better prepare to detect and interdict a UK-style attack here in the States?
Well, I think the NYPD is trying to do, that's the model that they're working on, which is prevention, also L.A. But to do prevention, you must do surveillance, and both overt and covert surveillance, and that's key. And I think where we draw those lines and what form of surveillance is appropriate, that issue has not really been debated enough in our communities. It's a tough line to draw. A lot depends on the culture of a community. We spoke in the beginning about the British just being much more tolerant of, and the French, I would, having lived there, say the same thing, much more tolerant of government intrusion, photographing, monitoring emails. Americans are not comfortable with that. And until you have a buy-in by the public into these techniques, and maybe you won't have it, you better be careful when you try and do them, because you will have a blowback. You will have a reaction that could shut down some very important operations and law enforcement activities. In New York, there really needs to be, I think, a greater discussion between the civil libertarians, the civil liberties community, the ACLU, the Human Rights Watch people, and the NYPD. Right now, they're meeting in court. That's not a good way to solve problems and to find common ground. And I remain optimistic, perhaps some people say naively so, that if that people of goodwill can sit down and hammer these issues out and come to a consensus.
One thought that this gentleman had suggested is looking at those servicemen and women that have the combat experience from Iraq and Afghanistan, taking jobs in police, fire, and emergency medical fields. Do you see these experienced combat experience veterans having skill sets that might be useful in domestic application?
Absolutely. In fact, I was embedded for 3 months with the Weapons of Mass Destruction Hunters. That was talk about Mission Impossible. But these were extraordinarily talented young men and women who came from Fort Sill, mm-hmm. from the 75th Field Artillery Brigade. They weren't especially trained to do this, but the skills they learned for the hunt for WMD in Iraq, I think have enormous application here at home. And once again, we should be willing to use these people, and local law enforcement ought to make it a priority to hire some of them. They have extraordinary skills, and now they have interest and commitment. And I think we could do a much better job of, they could do a much better job of tapping into that skill set.
Now, what about the vehicle-borne IED threat. You mentioned that a little bit. Do you see similarities or contrasts in the U.S. versus those in Southwest Asia, particularly as relates to use of chlorine gas in explosive devices?
That was one of the issues covered by the most recent SHIELD briefing. Chlorine gas shipments through the city, the possibility that someone might decide to blow up one of those tankers. I think there is great concern in New York about this, but fortunately there is also a simultaneous effort to minimize the number of such transport shipments through the city, to make sure we know when those shipments occur, who's coming, at what hours, carrying what kinds of material. Knowledge is critical, and once again, local law enforcement, the NYPD, the traffic department must know when something is unusual. I think that's our challenge, spotting something unusual. In New York, almost nothing is unusual, which makes makes this a kind of a serious challenge for local law enforcement. But if you see a big truck that usually isn't in a neighborhood, that is configured in a way that may to carry a gas, yeah, you're going to worry. You're going to wonder what they're doing. They're double parked at an unusual hour. It's all a question of distinguishing the known, the expected from the unexpected, and that comes with time and it comes with information, which is why these briefings are so crucial, especially to the private sector in New York.
Well, I want to ask one last question before we close out. Throughout the interview, you've been talking a little bit about your concern with the civil liberties issues, and I think you're advocating that there should be more discussion between local law enforcement and the ACLU and civil liberties proponents. Do you have any closing thoughts on that beyond what you already said?
I think that some of the most valuable programs that are being run by local law enforcement are in jeopardy because of this growing suspicion and the growing opposition of the civil liberties community. And the reason I'm focused on this at the moment is not only that there is a major lawsuit making its way through the courts in New York, but both LA and New York are reconsidering the guidelines that govern what constitutes appropriate surveillance. In L.A., Commander Downing told me on the record, absolutely, the guidelines that we have with respect to the surveillance do not permit us to do things that we need to do to keep the city safe. Our guidelines, which are the result of previous abuses by previous police chiefs, well known and unacceptable, that those guidelines now, in light of the terrorist threat, need to be revisited and revised. New York has already done that, but its revision is being challenged. It's called the Hanshu Guidelines, being challenged in court. If the civil libertarians have their way and the access to this daily programmatic information, the flow of information, raw intelligence data is given to them, I think some of these programs would be shut down. And I think that would be a shame for the city, because I don't think that the NYPD, given what I know, and once again, I've got to caveat this, given what I've seen so far, I don't think the NYPD has crossed the line. Mm-hmm. But I think the civil libertarians have a point. Mm-hmm. When they say, well, you may trust Ray Kelly and David Cohen to conduct this kind of surveillance, but what about their successors? Mm-hmm. How much surveillance do we really want? And who's going to guarantee that this information isn't going to be abused? Because we've seen a lot of that lately. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So each side has a legitimate set of concerns, and there must be a way to bring these two communities together to discuss them other than through lawsuits. That's not a way you resolve anything happily. And I'm very concerned about this at the moment, really concerned.
Well, Judy, this has been great. I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with us. Good luck in your future endeavors, and thanks for your service to our country.
Thank you very much.
This has been a Domestic Preparedness podcast interview. Thank you for listening.